You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning. My name is Chen Li, Director of the John L. Sutton China Center here at Brookings. It gives me great pleasure to welcome you all for today's event, the Chinese Discourse on Moral Decay in the People's Republic of China. The topics of the moral decay and the lack of trust in present-day China are not sensitive topics. And certainly not political taboos in the PRC. In the wake of horrifying food and drug safety scandals and other well-known or well-publicized incidents pointing to a moral crisis in the country, top Chinese leaders, both former and current, have publicly acknowledged that, I quote, the moral decay and the loss of trust have reached an extremely serious point, end quote. These intriguing phenomena highlight the great need for ethical discourse in a country that is increasingly seen by some critics as both a materialistic giant and a spiritual dwarf. Paradoxically, however, this ongoing discourse also demonstrates a serious effort to rebuild the Chinese collective consciousness and the social norms necessary for an ethical awakening. To a broad extent, the ongoing Chinese discourse on ethics reflects a painstaking search for modern virtues in an ancient civilization, a search for what 21st China really represents in terms of values and beliefs. The ramification of this Chinese discourse on ethics will be felt beyond China's national borders, especially now that the country is re-emerging as a global power. This morning, we are so honored to feature some of the greatest minds and most articulate voices in the world on the subject. First and foremost, we are privileged to be joined by Dr. He Huaihong, Professor of Philosophy at Peking University, who traveled from Beijing here. This event also serves as a launch of the publication of his first English book entitled Social Ethics in a Changing China, which is the newest volume of the Sutton Center Chinese Thinker Series. Over the past two decades, Professor He Huaihong, his scholarly writings, public lectures, and media interviews in China have transformed the Chinese public's understanding of the moral predicament underlying many news headlines and the controversial issues. Perhaps more effectively and constructively than anyone else, Professor He Huaihong is bringing ethics back into Chinese discourse. Professor He, we are happy to have you today at Brookings and look forward to hearing your keynote remarks. For the second panel, we have the distinguished honor to assemble America's leading scholars on China, but representing various academic disciplines and point of views. They all happen to be Chinese Americans. And my colleague, non-resident fellow at Brookings, Evan Osnos, served as a moderator for the panel. A staff writer for New Yorker magazine, Evan's first book, Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China, based on 8 years of living in Beijing, won the 2014 National Book Award. I also should add that we hired him and before his nominations for National Book Award. And he has now emerged as the second most sought after public speaker on China. Of course, the first is Professor Jonathan Spence. And so it's a quite achievement, Evan. We're very proud of you. Evan will introduce the panel speakers in a more formal way, but please allow me to say a few words about the other panelists for the panel. Mingxin Pei is a dear personal friend, and our Washington audience is very familiar with his work. In fact, more than anyone else, Mingxin helped me adjust to the Washington environment when I arrived here 9 years ago. But he then moved to California, where he teaches at an excellent liberal arts college. Really, I'm very much, you know, envy you. Foreign Policy magazine recently named Mingxin as one of the most influential thinkers in the world, and that title is well-deserved. Mingxin, we are so happy to have you back to Washington. Hope that you will speak at Brookings more often in the months and years to come. So it's really Brookings again at the Carnegie's loss. Dali Yang is also a dear personal friend. We were classmates at Princeton, so therefore we are really, in Chinese, we call academic brothers, you know, 师兄. And about 10 years ago, Mingxin, Dali served as the chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Chicago. This was the first time a PRC-born scholar has that title. And I should say that Dali will always be able to claim that remarkable achievement. There's no other PRC-born scholars after him ever served that position. Last but not least, Professor of Anthropology at UCLA, Yan Yongxiang, who actually I have met for the first time today. However, I have known about his work for really 2 decades, as his anthropological research has strong implications on other academic disciplines, including political science. Professor Yan changed his schedule in order to come to speak with us this morning, and we are very, very grateful. And unfortunately, Professor Jonathan Spence and Professor Anping Chen were supposed to be here this morning, but we got a phone call early this morning that their flight was canceled. You know, we tried to arrange the, what's called the Skype, but it still could not work. And so, of course, we are all disappointed about this, but know that in their absence, we still have an unparalleled group of distinguished scholars with us today. Please join today's discussion with through our Twitter, Brookings China. And also, we will post a video of this event to our website in the coming days. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming our first keynote speaker, a philosopher, a historian, and a social critic, Professor He Huaihong.
Thank you very much for this invitation. Thank you very much for inviting me, and thanks to everyone.
今天我主要想讲三点，第一点就是中国的历史文化传统。 是最不坏的一种传统。第二点，就是现代社会的伦理的基本的形态，我认为是一种底线伦理。第三点，不求最快，但求长久。
Okay, so today, basically, there's three things that I'd like to discuss here. First of all, as historical cultural traditions go, the Chinese historical cultural traditions, we can say, are the least bad. The second thing is that the fundamentals of modern social ethics are basically minimum moral standards or minimum ethical standards. And the third idea is about striving not to be the fastest, but about striving to achieve something that's lasting.
就是我这个来这里之前，10月的27号，我去北京大学讲课，来回坐公共汽车。 一上车都有人给我让座，这个而且都是年轻人。当然我稍稍还是感到有点悲哀，我是不是，你们看我是不是很老了？
But first I want to tell you a true story. Recently, it was October 27th, I was on a public bus in Beijing. I was on my way to and from Peking University to teach. And on the way, on the bus, both there and back, young people were giving up their seats for me. They were all young people. And I felt a little bit bad. What do you guys think? Do I look that old?
当然我还是很感谢让座的年轻人哈。不过我也问自己一个问题，就是这些让座给我的人，如果碰到一个老人，不认识的老人摔倒了，他会不会去搀扶他？因为中国最近发生很多这样的事情，就老人摔倒了不敢去搀扶，不敢去扶起来啊，因为要去扶一个摔倒的老人是有风险的，就是说可能被赖上哈，说要支付就是你碰倒的，你要支付医药费等等，甚至后面很多经费。现在还有的也确实有这样的现象，就在有的老人故意碰瓷，我不知道怎么翻哈，来讹诈。
Well, of course, I was thankful that those young people all gave up their seats for me. But then I asked myself a question. I was thinking, what if it were an elderly person that had fallen on the ground? Would these young people pick that elderly person up after a fall? Because everyone knows that in China today, a lot of people don't dare do that when they see an elderly person fallen, because there's always a risk involved. There's a risk that you might end up having to pay for that elderly person's medical bills. Some of our elderly, I don't know, we have a specific term in Chinese, and some of them, what they do is they fake an injury, and then they try to extort money out of the person who picks them up and then ends up taking them to the hospital.
所以有一句话是，就是，那么发生这样的情况是老人变坏了呢，还是坏人变老了？
So we always keep asking ourselves, have the elderly become bad, or have the bad guys just gotten old?
因为如果是前面一种情况，可能是说现在社会的道德问题比较大，原来比较好的老人都变坏了。但是如果是后一种情况呢，就是说现在社会其实道德还不错啊，坏的只是比较老的人，经常说是什么，比如从文化大革命过来的人，他们当时是年轻人，我就是一个，他们当时比较好斗啊，可能还实际上也比较自私啊，因为世上也发生过有的老人甚至逼着这个别人让座，也有这样的情况。
So if it is the former, that the elderly have become bad, as it were, then that probably shows that there are major moral issues that we're facing today in our society with the general coarsening of morality. Even if that's the case, it means that even the elderly who've always been more moral, they're now being affected by the whole trend and they've become less moral. If, however, it's the latter, then that tells us that we still may live in a moral society. It's just the elderly who are the bad ones. Perhaps a lot of them lived, obviously, through the Cultural Revolution. I was young back then, too, myself. And even back then, they got angry. They liked to pick fights. And a lot of them are actually selfish. And sometimes they even make other people give up their seats for them on buses.
这当然不是一概而论哈，就是老年人不好，年轻人好，或者是反过来说，其实当然有些共性，就老年人当然是比较固执一些，容易发脾气，也比较关心政治，关心国家大事。年轻人呢，比较有现代的文明礼貌，但是呢，也可能对有些不合理的制度啊，包括政治不那么关心，或者很相当的顺从。所以有位北大的教授，我的同事哈，这个钱理群先生曾经就是说现在中国的大学在培养许多年轻的精致的利己主义者。
Of course, we can't make sweeping generalizations and say all old people are good or all young people are bad or vice versa. The elderly, though, may appear obstinate, stubborn, or they have short tempers, and they often end up, they lose their tempers. But actually, if we look a little deeper, it's the elderly who are more interested in, they take an interest in politics, what's going on around the country, and what's going on around the world. And young people, while they appear very modern and they think of themselves as modern and they're very civilized, very polite, the thing about them is often when they're faced with unfair institutions or rules or things in the political system that aren't good, they actually are just willing to comply and go along more so than the older generation. And as a matter of fact, I have a colleague at Peking University, a friend of mine who's a professor there, Professor Chen, and he said that Chinese universities, what they're doing is now training up a crop of young people who are polished in the art of egoism.
当然这些问题关于中国的道德现状以及它的这个社会礼仪以及制度伦理，我想留给后面的 panel 这个好几位这个哈教授他们来一起讨论。现在我想就我的书讲三点哈。
As for these specific questions that I throw out for discussion, I'm not going to talk to them specifically. I'll be leaving them for some of our other speakers who will follow, and they can talk about that. What I'd like to do now is discuss three aspects from my book.
第一点就是我想说中国的历史文化传统啊，是一种最不坏的传统。大家知道这是有点仿效丘吉尔说的，民主是一种最不坏的制度，不说是最好的，但最不坏的啊。如果从现代民主社会的观点来看，传统可能都不是太令人满意的，但是尤其中国可能不满意到了相当极端的程度啊。有些先进的中国人可能认为中国传统一直说是很坏的，甚至是最坏的一种传统。
First, I would like to say that Chinese historical cultural traditions basically represent something that is the least bad among historical cultural traditions. What I'm trying to say here is sort of borrowing from Winston Churchill. Back then, he said that democracy was the worst form of government except for all others. So I'm not exactly saying that, but I'm saying it's the least bad. If we look at it from the perspective of a modern democratic society, these historical traditions might seem to us all as unacceptable. And that's definitely true. There's some Chinese people who consider themselves to be very mod, and they are not satisfied with any of that. They don't like any of it. They just think Chinese tradition is bad, and maybe even the worst of all traditions.
但是在我的这个书里面哈，我认为和世界上其他文明的文化历史传统相比较，中国的历史文化传统其实不仅悠久，而且是最不坏的传统之一。它自有它的历史价值，有它的精致优雅，而且维系了人类数量最大的一个群体的文明几千年的延续。
However, in my book, I do argue that when compared with the cultural traditions of other civilizations in the world, Chinese historical cultural traditions are one of the least bad. Our Chinese cultural traditions have their own historical values, and they're not only a tradition and a set of cultural traditions that have been there a long time, they also have their own refined elegance. They have managed to hold together the largest human civilization for thousands of years.
而且它到今天也还有重要的意义，它可以调整，当然也要改造的和现代社会可以还是可以相融啊。另外它对现代社会的弊病其实也还可以提供一些啊调整的方案，所以我在我的书里面大量的是引用了传统的思想和制度的资源来建构现代中国社会的伦理。这里我只想重申一点，就是桑顿先生在书的序言里面他提到的 啊，就是 selection society 这个概念啊，我有一本书就是这个书名哈、啊，也就是说，传统中国通过两千多年从推荐到考试，啊，就是从差举到科举的制度，就是不论出身多么寒微啊，贫富贵贱如何。还是给了几乎所有人进入政治上层的平等机会的争议。
And furthermore, even now, those traditions that have this old long history are still very relevant actually in today's society. Of course, it might take some tweaking here and there, and it might take some reforming, but they can be made to fit into today's society, and they are useful, actually, even in helping us cope with the problems that we do face today. So I've used a lot of traditional thought and even institutional resources to come up with these modern Chinese social ethics. But I would just like to point out here again the concept of a selection society that John Thornton talks about in his foreword at the beginning of my book. Historically, for more than 2,000 years, China had been what began as a recommendation system, and then it moved to an examination system. And under these systems, it didn't matter how humble your origins were. Almost everyone that they were able to experience a kind of justice because they had equal opportunity to advance to the highest levels of government as long as they did well on the exams.
结果是什么了？我这里举两个例子哈，就是比如像这个何炳棣，这个是在美国哈，这历史学家他那个有一个就写明清。两代的社会流动啊，在他的研究中表明，就是明清两代的进士有50%-60%，有时候甚至60-70%是来自上面三代没有任何做官的家庭。
I'll give a couple of examples that resulted as a result of that type of a system. There is a U.S. historian, He Li Di, and he has done a lot of research into the social mobility that existed during the Ming and Qing dynasties. And according to his research and what it shows, 50, 60, even as close to 70% of the officials that were able to pass these examination exams came from families where there were no officials in their families for three generations.
我也可以举中国两个著名的社会学家费孝通和潘光年的研究，他们认为就是中国古代社会的垂直流动啊，超过跟现代社会做一个比较，他认为超过了现代社会的垂直流动。
And there have also been, as another, by way of another example, Chinese researchers and scholars, Fei Xiaotong and Pan Guangyan, they've said that in ancient China, vertical mobility in their society was better than it is now.
不仅来自下层官员，应该说大部分都有相当高的文化水准和道德的自觉意识。当然，是不是做得非常好，这还要再看，但这是两千多年这种现象是世界文明可以说没有的现象啊。这个现代社会的选举 election 我觉得也没有达到这样的一个标准。我再举一个例子，就是美国有一个学者写，是不是叫权力精英 Paul 米尔斯，不知道权力精英，那他举了一个例子，说现在美国的总统读什么书啊？他说读侦探小说，比如他举艾森豪威尔哈。他说过去的开国的美国总统读什么？读洛克，读卢梭。他觉得这个文化水准大大的降低了。当然，你们有个更好的例子，你们可能会说小布什。
So basically, you can see that they came from the lower levels of society, and they became educated, and they were morally conscious, these people back in those days under that system. Well, whether or not they achieved a perfect level of morality and whether the system was perfect, that's something that's left to talk about, but it lasted for more than 2,000 years. And if you look at now the election system, if we compare this to the election system, let's say, that we have in the United States, there was a researcher by the name of Mills, who talked about what American presidents read. Well, in the past, American presidents read things like detective, you know, mysteries, those types of books. That was in modern history. But if you go back to the founders of our country, they read things such as Locke and Rousseau.
第二点就是我认为哈，现代社会的伦理基本形态是一种底线伦理。我从90年代起哈，一直提倡一种底线伦理，有这样一本书，其实《良心论》也是在讲底线伦理。在我看来，现代社会它应该是面向所有人的，啊，而不是像传统的等级社会，它主要是要求上层、君主、官员。现代社会它是要求所有人的。这样了，就像现代社会是一种走向平等的社会一样，啊，现代伦理也应该是一种平等的，当然也是普遍要求的伦理。
The second thing is that I argue that the fundamentals of modern social ethics are what I refer to as minimum moral standards, and I've advocated such minimum moral or ethical standards since the 90s.As I see it, modern social ethics should be directed at everyone. Everyone should have the expectation of being able to live up to these ethical standards. It shouldn't be as it was traditionally back in our the days of our hierarchical society, where it was mostly the upper class and the officials who were expected only them to observe these ethical standards. Just as our societies are now moving toward equality for all, in terms of ethical expectations,those expectations should also reflect that kind of move toward equality.
这样的话，比如传统社会，它的伦理叫君子伦理，它是要求不是所有人，它要求官员、士大夫成为努力向圣贤看齐、但是呢，老百姓只是。不那么要求，比如打个比方哈，比如清代的法律，老百姓可以去妓院，但是官员不允许，就是要求是不一样的，
So basically, back in the old days, we had different standards for different types of people, depending on what your position was in society. There was a differentiation, and for those who were officials and those who were in power, they were expected to be like a saint or like a sage, and we wanted them to achieve that level, but we didn't have the same type of expectations at all, for regular people.
这实际上是就是和现代伦理的一个区分。一个基本的区分，从康德开始的区分很有关系，就是说要区分价值和规范，也就是说你的价值追求、生活方式，包括终极关切和信仰，这是不要再普遍要求了，你自己决定。但是社会的这个基本的行为规范啊，这个是需要普遍要求。现在伦理的要求就缩小到了，你也可以说降低到了这些最基本的行为规范上。
So we need to differentiate between basic social norms and the pursuit of higher values. Actually, this type of a concept started way back with Immanuel Kant, when he talked about values and norms. We shouldn't be asking everybody to behave like a saint or a sage. What we need to be doing is requiring that everybody respect basic norms instead. Of course, for those who choose to hold themselves up to the highest ethical standards, they are always welcome to continue working harder to develop themselves in pursuit of that. But for the society as a whole, we should give precedence to fulfilling basic obligations and not necessarily pursuing the highest values and ultimate concerns that people can do on their own if they want to.
换句话说, 最个人, 你去追求最喜欢的, 最好的生活方式或者信仰, 但是社会, 伦理, 包括法律, 啊, 他们是要优先考虑, 所有人能够遵守基本的义务和职责, 他优先考虑的是防止那些最坏的事情发生, 使社会崩溃的事情发生。
In other words, individuals are more than welcome to choose a higher lifestyle or a higher set of beliefs and do better than the basic minimal moral standards for themselves. But from the perspective of the society as a whole, looking at ethics and laws, what we should be giving precedence to is fulfilling basic obligations and responsibilities, preventing the worst things from happening, preventing a collapse of the whole society.
最近几年，包括像习近平，他多次谈到底线思维，就是说要防止最坏的情况发生，也谈到中国是一个大国，所以绝不要在根本性的问题上犯颠覆性的错误。不知道是不是也有这样的考虑？
And in recent years, a lot of people, high-level officials, including Xi Jinping himself, brought up the idea of minimum standards for thought many times, several times. And Xi Jinping has said that China is a big country, and as such, it should avoid making mistakes which would end up being disastrously disruptive on issues that are fundamental to the country. Perhaps he's thinking along the same lines here?
还有目前这个反腐败也可以说是一种对底线伦理的一种践行，当然是要求主要要求官员。其实中共的领导人多次谈到，如果不大力反腐败，就可能亡党亡国。虽然这是在一党或者党国一体的立场上来说的。
Also, the anti-corruption movement, which everyone knows about in China and is supported by the people, that could perhaps be seen as the practice, putting into practice of these minimal moral standards. Of course, this movement is aimed mostly at government officials. But Communist Party leaders have said repeatedly that if we do not go all out against corruption, then that will be the demise of the party, the demise of the country. And even though, of course, we have to remember that they're saying that from the standpoint of their one party or standpoint of a country where the party and the country are one.
第三也是最后一点，就是不求最快，但求什么呢？我不想说但求最好，我是说但求长久，因为对最好其实也要警惕。 那么这个长久对一个社会来说，就是长治久安，对人类来说呢，可以就是说一种可持续的发展，或者是真正意义上的持久的幸福，而不是很快就要过去的快乐。因为中国词翻译这个 pleasure 就是说是快乐，快乐就是。
The third thing is, if we don't strive for top speed, then what should we be striving for? I don't want to say we should be striving to be the best. As a matter of fact, I'm a little bit wary of saying that. I would like to use the word, we want to do something that's lasting, For an entire society, that would mean lasting peace and stability. For the human race, it means the pursuit of sustainable development and lasting happiness, in the true sense of the word, though, not a moment of fleeting pleasure. Because when we think of these words in Chinese and translating them into, interpreting them into English, pleasure is not the word I want to use here, because pleasure is just fleeting, and it's done right away.
就现代社会啊，它是以几乎我们看几乎各个国家它的合法性的一个主要来源都是经济，就是它经常是以经济为中心，而且呢追求经济的高速发展，但是不是始终都要追求最快，这是其实还是有危险的，因为这带来物质主义和消费主义的许多问题。这个问题当然不是仅就中国而言，包括中国，但是也是就世界和人类而言。
In the modern world, in the modern society that we live in, all countries are concerned with their economics and their economic development. It's all about economics and fast economic growth.But do we always have to be the fastest? I think always trying to be the fastest is actually pretty dangerous. Thinking that way will bring a lot of issues that might arise out of materialism, consumerism. So this actually is not specific to China. It includes China, but it concerns the whole world and all of humanity.
就越来越快是不是一种好的速度？我们知道在伽利略的试验中，加速度实际上是一种坠落的速度，人类的文明史，也就是说从狩猎采集，转向农耕畜牧，然后又走向国家发明文字，这样的历史其实对人类来说只有一万来年，或者说一万两千年，只有这么长时间，一万年左右。
So yeah, faster is not always better. In Galileo's experiments, actually, an increased speed was associated with the speed of falling bodies. So in the history of the civilization of humankind, we began with hunting and gathering, and then with farming and herding, and then we formed nations. We invented writing systems. We've only gone through 10,000 or a little more than 10,000, or I might say 12,000 years to get to that point.
这个毛泽东有一个著名的诗句，就是一万年太久，只争朝夕，也这一万年差不多也就是人类的文明史啊。
Chairman Mao had a famous line in a poem where he said, 10,000 years is too long to delay, seize the day. That 10,000 years that he's talking about is pretty much the same 10,000 years that it took us to do all the things that I just mentioned.
但是从人类的历史也许可以有几百万年，地球的历史有46亿年，那么这个相比较，一万年和这个相比较其实是很短的，是不是还要只争朝夕啊？
So looking at it from the perspective of human history, 10,000 years is not a long time, because what about millions of years, and what about even 4.6 billion years? 10,000 compared to 4.6 billion is nothing. It's extremely short. So I think maybe we should still seize the day.
这个我们知道哈，这个过去地球上最有力的、最强大有力的动物是恐龙，但是它们已经灭绝了。但是它们在地球上毕竟生活了1亿多年。现在地球上当然是人类是最智慧也最有力量的动物，那么它是否有能够比恐龙更长久的历史？
The strongest and mightiest creature that ever walked this earth was the dinosaur. Today they're extinct, but they did live on this earth for over 100 million years. Today humans are the wisest and most powerful creature on earth.But the question is, will we be able to survive for a longer time than the dinosaurs did?
所以我认为今后人类要可能更多的考虑长久的问题，而不是 加速的问题。在这方面也许可以体会哈，就是中国古代智慧中我觉得一种淡的滋味和慢的节奏。我就讲完了，谢谢大家。
So I believe that humans need to spend more time thinking about what's long-lasting and less time just trying to speed up. Perhaps in this context, I can call on everyone to see if we can appreciate the lightness and slow rhythm of ancient Chinese wisdom. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Well, could you hear me? Is that okay? Professor He, I think you personify the best of Chinese tradition, the lightness, and also the slow rhythm. And really, basically, a remarkable presentation, and you certainly reflect that. And I would say that it's really, you are a master of the art of public speaking, can use that very simple language to explain complicated issues and profound ideas. I will raise a few questions and based on your book and based on your presentation. Let me start with the first one from a more historical perspective. And I try to imagine that if Jonathan Spence is here, what kind of question he will ask. So as you know, there's a very famous Chinese saying that vividly captured the ramification of the spiritual or moral decay in present China, really from a historical perspective. Let me repeat that in Chinese first. 明亡之后无华夏, 满清之后无汉人, 文革之后无信仰, 改革之后无道德. My colleague Sun Yun, she probably is not here, and she helped me translate it into English. I think it's a beautiful translation. This is a translation. China lost its middle kingdom with the end of the Ming Dynasty, lost its Han ethnicity with the conquest by the Qing Dynasty, lost its faith with the Cultural Revolution, and lost its morality with economic reform. Now, you wrote in the book, fundamental trust and fundamental kindness are being lost in our society. Could you elaborate to our audience on this startling assessment? Now, your oral presentation only mentioned this in passing. I would like to you briefly highlight the key traditional virtues that you think that the Chinese should work to restore. And also, what kind of a contemporary ethical codes that the Chinese now should embrace?
Okay. 就是这个刚才这个问题我想说的哈，就是说我们碰到非常严重的道德问题，确实是如此。其中一个是基本的信任和善意有时候是在我们社会中丧失，就是这个指的是主要是政治的互相信任。就是说中共的领导人也谈到过，说好像陷入一种塔西佗，就罗马历史学家塔西佗陷阱，就是说政府说的话什么都不相信，包括真话。然后从有一些知识分子来说，从党内包括也有一些官员，他也时常在怀疑别人要推翻自己，
只要是持异议，持异议的是要推翻自己，所以这两方面很不这个很不互信，这是一个最关键，对一个社会啊也是最重要的一种互信，但是这方面出现了一些比较严重的问题。
Okay, thank you for the question, and here is how I would like to answer it. It's true. Currently, we do have quite a serious problem with morality in our society in China now. And basically, the issues are that we lack a basic trust and we lack kindness.So when I'm talking about trust, I'm even including in the political realm, trust in our political leaders. If you look at the leaders from our Chinese Communist Party in our government today, it seems that some of them have fallen into a Tacitus trap. And what that means is whatever the government says, the people don't believe any of it. Even when they say things that are the truth, the people still don't believe it. This is true inside the party and for the government officials. This is what they're facing. And a lot of it, they, on the other hand, are also very mistrustful and very worried. Whenever they hear dissent or opinions that aren't the same as theirs, they're always worried that they're going to be overthrown or overturned. So trust is a major problem, and this is key. This is very important, and it's a serious issue today.
当然我认为哈，比如说中国共产党它和它自己的历史相比应该是一个，就和它自己的过去相比应该是一个还是很不错的时候，它现在正在承受过去的一些遗产，这遗产对它是很沉重的，但是也不能够完全丢掉，比如有些意识形态的遗产，包括有一些在动员时代，二十世纪动员时代，为了动员群众起来革命夺取政权，有一些不真实的东西，那么现在他不得不维护，为了自己的合法性不得不维护。
So, of course, I think that the Chinese government, the Chinese leaders, and our party, the Communist Party, if you compare it to other points in its own history, compared to what it was like in the past, I think it's pretty good today in comparison. But it does have a lot of legacies that it's left over from the past, which are heavy burdens for it. And a lot of it, it's trapped under these heavy burdens, and it can't just get rid of them just like that. Some of them are ideological. And, for instance, during the 20th century, it was kind of a mobilization era where people were mobilized to go and do things, and there were movements toward that end. And they were mobilizing people, they were carrying out revolutions, and they took over the government. And in that process, they did say things that weren't entirely true, but they're saddled with that.
所以我认为，比如现在哈，这个当局它诉诸就中华民族的历史传统，这个方向还是对的。就是说，啊，这个他试图这个把和过去的一些礼，就是我说传统的德性，刚才哈李晨先生讲，就传统的德性，比如仁义礼智信啊，这个以及比如说现代的新的德性，比如平等啊、宽容，这个有所结合，我觉得这从社会，当然不是我认为主要的希望还是在民间社会这样一种道德的苏醒和活力啊，但是政府这样做我觉得也挺好的。
So what I think is that if you look at our government and our authorities, they are trying to work at the same time from historical traditions, but move in the right direction. And I think they're basically going in the right direction. In the past, very traditionally in ancient Chinese culture, we talked about benevolence, righteousness. We talked about formalities, wisdom and trust, those five qualities, politeness. Whereas in the modern era, they're also trying to tie those good things from our past with some of the modern trends, such as equality and compassion. However, it's not just for the government to do this alone to sort of have a moral awakening in China. I think we need our civil society to play a very important role, but I think the government is doing basically a good job.
Well, for the sake of debate, and I wanted to offer a contrasting view, and I would like to challenge the main thesis of your book about the perceived moral decay in present-day China. One can argue that the ongoing Chinese discourse on moral decay is nothing new. About 100 years ago, during the May 4th movement, that movement is also about, on both sides, about the moral decay, and also the concern about the imperative for ethical reconstruction and the spiritual enlightenment. One can also go back to ancient time, and it's really almost 3,000 years ago that during the spring and autumn period, another intellectual renaissance era in China's long history, when some wise men, of course only men at that time, wise men were deeply upset with what they call or perceive disintegration of propriety, what's the Chinese called, Li Ben Yue Huai. And here is my question. Is the perceived moral decay in present China really extraordinary or even unique? If so, what factors have made this a unique phenomenon? We may say that the one-child policy that really created led to the generation of selfish little emperors and princes. But as you know, that this could probably be unique, but you know that a week ago, Chinese government announced to end that policy. So as world history makes it very clear, a nation in the throes of rapid economic and social transformation is likely to experience some sort of a spiritual or ethical crisis. Now, what you referred early on, the cynicism of the government, I thought it's wonderful. I mean, we should be cynical about what the government told us. So is the fact that there has been a strong public awareness of the ethical issues in China itself is an encouraging sign for ethical awakening, maybe even a major enlightenment movement in the making? Could you respond to that? So the whole thesis of a moral decay, maybe it's a fake one.
他就是说其实那个道德也没什么败坏他就是嗯嗯啊这个就是关于道德危机或者失败的问题我想是一个老问题尤其是知识分子的一个老问题因为知识分子可以说是一个社会中最不满意的人
Actually, if you talk about the concept of a moral crisis or failure in our moral system, moral failure, that's really an old question that's been around since for a long, long time. And I think it's a question that intellectuals have been pondering for a long time because intellectuals are always the ones in our society who are unhappy with this and unhappy with that.
所以比如说在春秋的时代,孔子说过, 他很忧虑说现在社会礼崩乐坏。其实我们看后面的历史,看战国,就知道春秋还算是不错的了。Back
in the spring and autumn period, Confucius was so worried that there was a moral decline and that it was getting worse and worse and everything was on the downfall. But if we look back from today's perspective at what was going on then, things were pretty good then actually.
但是知识分子的提醒和警告我觉得是永远有意义的就是说对中国来说这个我觉得中国比较特别的地方就是道德的问题特别的地方在于中国经过二十世纪它走了一个相当彻底的反传统的 革命的道路，然后呢，受了这个苏联包括斯大林的体制的严重的影响。 所以呢，这个道德在很长时间一度完全被政治所替代或者淹没啊，这是第一个原因。第二点就是说，道德后来又被啊完全放手的市场经济冲击和淹没，就道德它没保持它的独立性，独立政治和经济的独立性，所以这个就是我觉得是主要的带来今天道德困境的两个原因。
However, the things that these intellectuals do bring up and warn us about and the reminders that we get from them are meaningful and we should pay attention to them. The thing about China in the area of morality and ethics is that it does have a situation that makes it different from other countries, and that during the 20th century, we in China went through a lot of things that was a complete reversal of our original ancient traditional values. And on top of that, we were affected in a big way by the Soviet Union and their values and Stalin. So, morality back then was less important than politics. It was buried. It took a backseat to politics. That's the first thing. And then with the onset of market economics and the new era, a lot of people paid no attention to morality and it got buried again by the economy, by market economics. So it wasn't able to survive independent of the trends in politics or economics. And I think that, is the main reason that we're having these moral issues that we're having in China today.
Let me move to another question. That in your remark, you mentioned that the traditional, moral or codes or moral standards, it's not only apply for elites. Now you talk about that the modern ethical codes should apply for everyone, not just the elites, but also the general public. You also created a very important concept over the past couple of decades, which is the minimum moral standards, 道德底线. I'm a little confused. You use that term because of you think now you apply for masses, you should know standard,or because officials are so bad, you lower standard to include them. Because as you know, that you really talk about the rampancy of official corruption, which is a serious problem. So here's my question, actually fourfold. First, or maybe three. First, what's the connection between these two? You know, the failure of society and rampancy of official corruption. This is number one. Number two, which one you worry most?Or worry more among these two? And finally, what should be the top priority and the key method to deal with these dual challenges?
这个我想起哈，我们这个叫什么习总啊，那个曾经说的要打老虎也要打苍蝇，对不对？那么其实还有这个老虎苍蝇可能都还指官员阶层，其实还有一个社会的问题。社会的问题就是比如像清华大学的社会学家孙立平曾经觉得，那不光是政治的问题，我们这个社会这个道德这个都有点崩溃了，出现很多问题。也就是说你不是一个官员，可能一个开门的人，他只要有一点点权力他都要用上啊。那么这就是一个社会的可能腐败的问题。
Okay, first of all, I would just like to say here that I think you all know about President Xi, and when he talks about going after, in his whole anti-corruption campaign, he's not only going to go after the tigers, but also the flies. I think you've all heard about that. I think when he talks all about that, he's basically talking about his campaign against corrupt officials. But it's not just the officials that we have to look at here. There is a professor, Sun Yipin, who mentions that it's the society itself. Society, even a person who is in, you know, he just might be in charge of, he might be a doorman and his job might be to open the door for you. Even people who are not officials with great power, they have a teeny tiny bit of power. They try to use that power and even abuse that power.
那么在这两个就是说苍蝇老虎或者说政治和社会这个道德问题哪个应该更优先的考虑和去解决那么在我看来当然还是政治因为中国几千年都是一个官本位的社会到现在也是一样官本位就是说他官员政治对社会的影响是很大的就是政治对社会的影响远远超过社会对政治的影响。
So, again, back to the flies and the tigers, or whether or not we should go after the political class or the society as a whole, the question is, if we're going to try to save the morality of our country, which takes precedent? Which should we look at first? I still think we need to look at it from the political class and from a political viewpoint, because since the beginning of time, China has always been a country where politics, the state is very important, the ruler has the power, and everybody sort of is very much... And they know that system, and they know it's very hierarchical. So politics affects our society much more so than the rest of the society affecting the political sphere.
但是和传统有一点不一样的地方就是说，我们说传统社会也很重视政治。这个，但是呢，它往往重视人的道德，个人的道德。我觉得在今天来说，我们可能要更重视就是制度的伦理。啊，就整个社会制度，它应该建立在什么样的正义原则之上？这要比考虑个人的道德，或者说仅仅清除一些腐败的官员，啊，更为重要。
But, the thing that I would just like to say here is traditionally we've, very much revered our rulers and politics has been so important in our country throughout the ages. But in terms of culture, in terms of individuals, morality and an individual person and what moral standards he should hold himself to, I think that, we need to have, institutional ethical systems. We need to have this based on the principles of justice. And I think doing that would be a lot better and would go a lot longer of a way than just, grabbing those corrupt officials and firing them or just going after individuals only.
Well, that's very nicely to link to my fourth and final question. It's really very much inspired by your point about the speed, the tension between speed and sustainability and towards the end of your formal presentation. Now, it reminds me a joke. In the middle of the cross-Pacific flight, the pilot announced to the passengers that he has good news and bad news. The good news, he said, we are ahead of schedule. The bad news is we are lost. Well, as we know that China has had unparalleled fast economic growth over the past three decades, but the country seemed to be lost in terms of political direction. It is fair to say that China has yet to find a sound, safe, sustainable political system, which you just mentioned, to accommodate rapidly changing economy and rapidly changing society. Your book aims to reconstruct a new intellectual framework of Chinese social ethics and values. At the beginning of your oral presentation, you also made an interesting argument that the Chinese culture tradition is the worst except all others. Now, I want to ask you to share with us your stance regarding universal values or universal ethics, especially how your concept of minimum moral standards relates to the ideas of universal values. Well, how should the Chinese tread the fine line between reserving Chinese ethical norms and promoting universal values at a time of unprecedented, multidimensional, and indeed very fast-paced globalization. Whether we like it or not like it, the pace is fast. So what's your view, what's your stance on this fine line between tradition, virtues in China, and embrace the universal values, and whether this is the approach that China should pursue.
就是我这里想再重申一下，就是我对，因为这涉及到普遍性的问题，就是重申一下，就是伦理学，它有一个现代伦理学有一个重要的基本的区分，就是区分价值和规范，或者说好与right 啊，就是说这个价值以及好，就什么是好，什么是对你好的东西，这个是可能不是普遍的，在今天传统伦理可能是普遍的，今天它不再是普遍的。这个普遍的是什么呢？是我应当怎么做啊？是 right 还是 wrong？ 就是说应当怎么做，道德上的哈啊，这个是可以做出一些比较普遍的区分来。
Okay, I would just like to state or even restate here, when we talk about the concept of universality and in the realm of ethics, especially modern ethics, it's important here to differentiate between values and norms and differentiate between good and right. The thing is, when you talk about values, what exactly is good?And also, today, I don't think we can really come up with something completely universal in terms of these questions. In the past, traditionally, it might have been universal, but that's no longer applicable in today's world. What we could try to do in terms of being universal is come up with how to determine what is right and what is wrong morally. I think that we could use universal principles to differentiate that.
但这个是学术上的一个区分，在日常语言中我们有时候不会那么严格的区分，有时候也说因为规范也是一种价值，比如说我们说这个 right, justice 也是一种价值啊，所以有时候我们就说普世价值或者普遍价值，笼统的说我也同意，但是呢真正的核心的，我觉得普遍是涉及到行为的那些最重要的规范，比如像基督教的经规啊，或者说像这个四不可啊，摩西世界里面四不可，不可杀人，不可啊，这些戒律，这是最基本的、最普遍的规范。
So actually, what I'm describing here are actually differentiations in the academic sense of the word. In our daily lives, sometimes we're actually not that specific on.The differentiation isn't that clear. So norms are different from values. But when we talk about what's right and what's just, those could be values. And generally speaking, I do agree with the idea that there could be universal values. But to get to what's really universal core issues, I think we could define them as maybe behaviors. For instance, in Christianity, they had their golden rule. And in China, Muashi, we had the four things that you couldn't do. These are all in terms of behaviors. So it's a discipline code of what types of behaviors are unacceptable.
所以这个最后想回答李晨先生的问题，就是说，即使是这些最基本的普遍的行为规范，它还是可以有不同民族文化传统的不同的表述，不同的资源啊。所以这是一点，在价值和生活方式方面，不同的民族 文化，它会有不同的，我在什么样的习惯里面我生活的最舒服，那么这个也是有各个民族的不一样。所以在这一点上，在无论是规范还是价值上了，我觉得都会涉及到各个民族文化传统的区别，这就是我理解的哈，就是特殊和普遍如何处理这样一种关系的一点看法。
So in answering this question and in trying to determine what's specific to some cultures versus what's universal, I would say that even the most basic behavioral normsare going to be expressed differently, and they're going to end up being slightly different depending on which culture you are watching or you are seeing them in. Values and ways of life, lifestyles, you have to see different countries, different customs, different cultures have different ways of, there'll be a different embodiment of these good values and good ways of life, because one culture or one nationality might have a certain custom, or they might be accustomed to doing something, or they just might be comfortable doing it a certain way. So for both norms and values, I think there will be a bit of a difference depending on what their cultural customs are. So that is how I'm going to answer the question of what's specific versus what's universal.
最后一句话就是，就好像这个生活方式不一样，就好像有些在美国在西方生活很多年，他说我还是一颗中国胃，他还是喜欢吃中国的生活这个饭食。
For instance, getting back to the issue of lifestyle, I could just say that, let's say I myself, even if I were in the United States or in the West for a long time, my stomach would still be a Chinese stomach, and I just would like to eat Chinese food.
Wow, this is so interesting. And so now I never thought that way. So I have a Chinese stomach, but brainwashed American mind or brain or what? And anyway... now let's open, we have 15 minutes for questions, and please identify yourself and make sure that we're not go beyond one question, and because for more discussion. Ambassador Roy, first.
I'm Stapleton Roy. I'm from the Woodrow Wilson Center. Professor He, thank you for your very thoughtful comments. You stressed in your remarks the importance of sustainability in ethical systems. But when you look at Chinese history and the dynastic cycle, you see a recurrent pattern of ethical decline, corruption of the ruling group, and the efforts to reverse those declines, even if they had temporary success, did not succeed in breaking the dynastic cycle of ethical systems declining into corrupt systems. All modern systems of governance are based on the concept that power corrupts, and therefore power has to be checked and balanced. This concept is missing in Chinese traditional political philosophy. If the concept is accurate, then the question is, how can China introduce those concepts as a means of dealing with the problem of corruption? Modern systems of governance have a built-in peaceful process for removing corrupt leaders and replacing them with leaders who have not held power and therefore are less corrupt than their predecessors. But the traditional patterns of governance didn't provide for that type of a replacement cycle. So I'd be interested in your comments, because in essence, the anti-corruption campaign that is currently underway illustrates the problem. The power holders have become corrupt from the very top down to the bottom. And the effort is to renew the problem by restoring ethical behavior, but without addressing the problem of its power that is the source of the corruption.
我觉得是一个非常好的，也是经常被问到的问题，就是说，这个中国历代这个官员，包括官员腐败，还有改朝换代，啊，这出了什么问题？当然，这个问题有多方面的，我觉得其中有一个问题是有人口的问题，人口的问题。 我不多说了哈，但是有体制的问题，就是他过于强调，刚才我说了个人的道德，但是呢，体制的道德这里最重要的就是权力的制衡，就是限制权力，这个呢，可以说是中国历史上确实不太成功，它是文官治理，强调文官的道德，但是呢，没有很多制度。 来限制权力，尤其是最高的统治者，就是君王君主的权力。那么这是一个很大的问题，很幸运的，就是说，我觉得中国历史上很多知识分子试图去寻找，但是他们没有找到的原因，他们不像西方，像地中海世界，它有很多参照，比如古希腊的民主制度啊等等。 他一直没有找到，那么今天我们说可以说是可以完全可以借鉴一种法治和民主，就是法律的统治和民主。这一点我是比较赞同，像李承先生的观点，强调法律的统治和民主，经过一种法律的统治去走向民主，也落实经由法治的民主，也是落实法治的民主。
Okay, that's an excellent question, and it's often a question that people often ask me. And for generations and for dynasties and hundreds and thousands of years, it's true, we have had this problem with corrupt officials, and then maybe the dynasty changed, people changed, but the problem came back. So, question here is what can be done about it, first of all, and what causes it and what to do. First of all, I would say that with our population, that's one issue that I'm not going to go into here, but that's an issue that causes the problem and makes it worse. But of course, there's the system itself. All since the beginning of our history, we've always emphasized personal morality and that officials had to hold themselves to the highest standards. But we really didn't have morality built into the system, so we didn't have these checks and balances. We didn't have a system in there to check the government's power. Instead, we always emphasized the idea of officials holding themselves to high standards. The system of checks and balances wasn't there, and it especially was never and has never been there on the highest ruler in the land, the monarch, the emperor. They just had nothing to check them. That is a very serious issue. And all throughout history, Chinese intellectuals have been looking at this issue, and they've been looking for something to do about this question and this problem. Looking at the West, the Mediterranean, the Greek societies, you had something that you founded your cultures on. We in China haven't found something, haven't brought something in to deal with checks and balances on government power. I think it's very important here to look at the rule of law and democracy by the rule of law. I think that Professor Li Cheng, he mentioned this too, and I think that rule of law to bring about democracy is very important, and I think we need to look at that in China going forward.
More question. Yes, the young lady.
Yes, thank you very much for the your remark and very interesting the ethic issues in China, although I'm not really expert in this field. Meiren Liu from Howard University School of Social Work, I'm working as an assistant professor there. So my question is, the discussion of ethics in China started back in, got really heated back in 2010, 2011. And in 2013, the government promoted the 24 core value of socialist moral values. Am I right? 24条那个社会主义核心价值观. I just want to know, and I saw this promotional slogan for this core values, you know, in China right now already. I just wonder, this reflect the government are trying to reconstruct the moral in China, of ethics in China, from what perspective, and what do you see the impact on the ethics in China, in Chinese society right now? Thank you very much.
If I may, we pick up a couple more questions and answer together. Yes, please. Yeah, microphone.
Thank you. This is Xu Wu from Arizona State University. You mentioned in your presentation actually that the Chinese Communist Party is burdened by its legacy, and especially if you listen to some of these officials talking about history, is either they are kind of ignorant or delusional or sometimes deceptive. So if the premise is true, then as long as CCP is in power and as long as they stick with the history storyline, how can we really get out of this this vicious cycle of moral decay?
Thank you. Thank you, and good to see you. I love your book. Yeah. And one more in the back, and the lady. Yes. Yes. Continue to raise your hand. Yes. Gentlemen, I'm sorry.
Good morning. I'm Lucio B. Pete Leader. I'm assistant professor and lecturer from De La Salle University in Manila. My question is not related to South China Sea. I understand that, thank you for the presentation. I understand that it's more domestic, but considering the questions you raise about the fundamental issues of trust and fundamental issues of kindness in Chinese society now, I'm interested in how this will impact on China's relations with neighbors. Thank you.
Another excellent question. We have three professors. Is there any journalist? I want to reserve the last question for you. Journalist? Okay, you're a journalist, right? The last row, yes.
Chief of Central Business Herald, but I'm not asking a question, but I have a media question. You talked about the 80s, 90s, the children were born in the 80s and 90s. I was born in 81. And this generation are considered to be little prince or little princess. But this is, from my point of view, it's not true. It's we are hardworking, we are studying hard, going abroad. Maybe this little prince, little princess was perceived by our parents' behavior. So do you think this is a stereotype?
Okay, now we close questions. Yes.
就是有一些问题综合起来回答哈。
I'm going to sort of try to talk to all of the questions and answer them all together.
那个就是刚才那位女生讲到的这个核心价值，就政府方面提出来的，还有这个哈，谈到这个就是说，我还是认为就是政治啊，权力是在中国目前的情况下能起很大的作用。
First of all, about what this woman in the back was asking her question about the 24, the Chinese government, the core values that they put out. Let me say it this way. I think that political power and the political sector, the political ruling class is still very important, and they play a very big role right now in China. I'll just give you an example from my own personal perspective. I translated a book, and it was hard work, and nobody gave me much recognition for it. But then when one of our leaders, like Wen Jiabao, goes and reads the book, immediately I can just get famous and I can make a lot of money, 500,000, et cetera.
No, 500,000 copies published.
Oh.
He did not get any.
I didn't make, even though I wasn't personally getting any money from it, there were 500,000 copies that came out. Okay.
So. 这里就是说我觉得这个现在政府可能有一点误区在于 他往往只是从政治上、宣传上也在鼓吹道德，但是重要的是让民间和社会有活力。这就意味着什么呢？道德是需要训练和培养的，社会的道德，这个培养是要通过组织，就民间的组织、社会的组织来培养。但是呢，现在我们的政府对好像几乎所有的非政府机构或者民间都不太放心，所以就缺少了一个非常好的训练我们自治能力以及社会道德的一个机会。
I still think that today in China there exists a misconception. I think that the government thinks that they can go out and put these things out and that immediately from the political level they're encouraging morality and that will just happen. But actually, the people, the civic society, the civil society, they actually are the ones where it should be happening. It needs to be, morality needs to be trained. It needs to be cultivated. It can't just be put out 24 things and then it happens. So I think it needs to be organized. It needs to be organized at the grassroots from the people. So a lot of our NGOs are worried about that, actually.
所以这个就是说，如果是我们能够处以就政府处以公心的话啊，我觉得能够让比如首先是慈善组织、公益组织，包括有些职业的组织，能够这个发展起来，这样呢，应该说也减轻了政府的很多负担，另外让民众能够通过这些组织啊训练自己的包括各种各样的德性啊，这个我觉得是应该是一个主要的一个方向。我的希望还是主要寄托在民间，光靠一些口号，比如以前的哈八荣八耻，我是一个伦理学家，连我都说不全八荣八耻是什么，我经常记不住，我所以我不知道，所以说你说它对一般的人有起什么多大的作用，我很怀疑。
Okay, so I'm actually quite skeptical about how much can actually be accomplished by the government just putting out some slogans or 24 principles. I think that, of course, the government, what they should do is to try to really benefit the society. They should allow the development as much as possible of charitable organizations, of NGOs, let them develop. And actually, first of all, in doing that, they could reduce the burden on the government to do it all themselves. But also, if the civil society, if these types of organizations were able to work through their organizations to train, to cultivate, to build up such virtues, that's what I think would be the best thing to happen. That's what I hope for the path going forward. And I don't hope that it's just going to be slogans, because if you just have slogans, sometimes they're very complicated slogans. I'm an ethicist. I study this. And I don't necessarily know what all of the 8 moral principles are supposed to be. I can't even remember them. And they expect that if they put these things out there, the people are just going to take them, copy them, and do them. It's not going to happen.
那个关于这个中国和菲律宾的关系，我是真的没有专门研究，啊，因为这涉及到历史啊、现实很多问题，就是说，没有研究，所以没有发言权。那么关于小霸王的问题，就是因为我的女儿哈，我的大女儿她就是80后，我觉得她确实，我没有觉得她。好像是这个可能社会上有这样一种说法，但是从我个人来看呢，我觉得他还是相当努力，包括他和他的朋友还是非常的努力，还是非常的那个。但是80后我们要记住，就是他和以前的这个年龄，比如70后甚至60后，更不要说我是50后，有很大的不一样啊。很大的不一样呢，就是说我觉得他们真正是在90年代，就是说因为他们懂事是在90年代以后，就是市场经济 中国的市场经济在90年代开始爆发，那么在这之后呢，他们的这个观念我觉得不像我们老是纠缠于政治，他们可能会更关注一些比较实际的问题，当然不意味着他们就不努力不奋斗，也不是说就很霸道但是真的是不太一样，这是有这个区别的。
And as for the issue of China and its neighbors or China and the Philippines relationships there, first of all, I don't know that much. This is not a topic that I even consider myself, that I even have any right to talk about. It touches on historical issues, it touches on current events and other issues, so I'm not really going to talk to that. And finally, as to the question of those born in the 80s, millennials, that generation, and whether or not they're like little emperors and whether they're spoiled and whether or not they don't work hard and they're lazy, I think people just say that, but I don't necessarily think it's true. My daughter was born in the 1980s, and I can see that she and even her friends, they work hard and they're good kids. I think people who are in the millennial generation born in the 80s and after 1980, they're different from those born in the 1970s and those born in the 1960s. They see things differently and, of course, very different from those of us born in the 50s like myself. But the other thing is they came of age in the 1990s. That was when they began to understand what was going on around them. And that was the age of the market economy in China. And so they don't always come back to politics. Not everything in their life revolves around politics. So that's the difference. But I think that they do work hard and they're not, little hegemons that demand everything from everybody.
Well, I wanted to add a few things for the question about the China-Philippine relations. Now, you see the effort from Chinese leadership, recent effort to improve relationship between China and Vietnam, and President Xi Jinping is going to visit Vietnam next week, and he's going to meet with Ma Ying-jeou of Taiwan in a couple of days. Right? And also some Chinese scholars define China's foreign policy, Xi Jinping's foreign policy, as a moral realism. So then you raise a question about the China's domestic moral decay. How could you do that? How could you make your neighboring countries believe you when you have terrible moral predicament at home? So therefore, they give the driving force to improve China's ethical codes and etc. This is a part of the reason that the Xi Jinping wanted to have a great rejuvenation of Chinese nation, and hope that he will good luck. And because of time, that we could not continue. And but I wanted to thank Professor He Huaihong again for leading this fascinating Chinese ethical discourse through your very prolific, very productive Chinese publication, through your influence upon Chinese leaders, through your first English book, with the Brookings Press, and also through your very insightful remarks with us this morning. I also want to thank the interpreter, really brilliant translation. It's my fault because I only mentioned 500,000 terms, not mention about the books. It's difficult to imagine that the 500,000 books, and actually from one edition, and you really should charge copyright. This is your rights, and et cetera. So I want the audience to join me to give a round of applause to thank you, Professor. So now I would like to invite my colleague, Aaron Osdorff, along with the distinguished Chinese-American scholars to present their perspective. And thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, please be seated. We will have our second panel very soon. So you are not going to use the phone. Ryan, could you check to microphone? Microphone. Someone will use later on, but not the beginning. In the beginning, probably you want to host over there. Yeah.
Everybody in this room is so ethically advanced that you fell into a deep silence the moment we got up here. Very gracious of you. I'm Evan Osnos. I'm a non-resident fellow here at the John L. Thornton China Center at Brookings. And it is a real pleasure to welcome you to this session on the moral predicament in present-day China. This is an event I've been looking forward to for a long time. I'm very grateful to Cheng Li for having me here and for convening this terrific group and for bringing in Professor He for us to hear his comments, which I certainly found stimulating this morning, and I'm sure a lot of you did as well. I want to add one brief point, which is that I can confirm Professor He's observation that in American politics today, there is very little discussion of Rousseau and Locke. I've been out recently interviewing presidential candidates, and I'm here to volunteer if we want to have a follow-up session on the moral predicament in America. We might have a pretty good conversation about that too. Before I introduce our panel today, I want to make a very brief personal observation about our subject of moral decay and ethical awakening. For a number of years in Beijing, I lived next door to the Confucius Temple. And when we moved in to the house in 2009, my wife and I, it was a very quiet next door neighbor. The only people who went in and out were a few administrators and the occasional visitor. And that changed very rapidly. In 2010, the Confucian Temple woke up in Beijing. And all of a sudden, for the first time, they celebrated the birthday of Confucius for the first time since the founding of the People's Republic in 1949. They created a stage show based on the Chinese classics, which played every hour on the hour, 7 days a week. And they also had, all of a sudden, an enormous number of visitors coming in from around China. And I will add, the stage show was so loud and so regular that one of my neighbors said to me, you know, you should go tell them to turn down the volume. And I said, why me? And he said, because you're a foreigner and they'll listen to you. I don't think I want to be known as the foreigner who asked China's most important philosopher to keep it down a little bit. The reason I mention this is that I do think it reflects something very interesting that's going on in China, which is at the same moment you have a genuine, authentic, deeply felt appetite for a reconstituted moral conversation, a moral discourse that feels to people as if it's been absent. And then at the same time you also have a top-down directed effort to control this process. The political authorities are very aware of this pursuit of a moral conversation, and they want to try to keep it within the boundaries that they feel comfortable with. And that combination of things, I think, sets us up for an interesting conversation today. Where is it going? Well, we've got three people with us who can help us decode this moment and map out where it's likely to lead us from different disciplines. I'll begin to my left is Min-Shin Pei. He's the Tom and Margot Pritchker Professor of Government at Claremont McKenna College, where he also directs the Keck Center for International and Strategic Studies. Min-Shin specializes in democratization in developing countries, economic reform, and governance in China. And his next book, which comes out next year, and I'm very much looking forward to it, from Harvard University Press, is China's Crony Capitalism, Dynamics of Regime Decay. Yunxiang Yan is professor of anthropology and director of the Center for Chinese Studies at UCLA. Anybody who's read my work knows that I make frequent reference to Yunxiang's work, and he has been really one of the foremost chroniclers of the intimate moral experience in China, the family, how it's changing, kinship, and, of course, the experience of being an individual in a globalized world. And he is now at work on a book on individualization and moral changes in post-Mao China. So very much on point with our discussion. And, of course, Dali Yang, who is the William Claude Rivas Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago. He's also the founding faculty director of the University of Chicago Center in Beijing. And Dali, over the years, has looked at a number of very interesting elements of the state-society relationship. His current projects include studies of social regulation, environmental governance, and the role of institutions and trust. And he'll be telling us more about that today. But Min-Shin, I'd love if you would start us off. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Evan. I also want to thank my good friend and esteemed colleague, Li Chen, for inviting me here. It's been 6 years since I left this town. So it's always good to be back. As someone who has just written a book on regime decay, I would concur with any suggestion that the Chinese Communist Party is undergoing through a process of institutional decay. But I would differ with my colleague, Professor He, on whether China is actually is experiencing moral decay. this is a very important topic, but it's also a very difficult empirical subject to study, because how do you measure moral decay in with any plausible or convincing numbers? So I will first talk about, I want to challenge the conventional wisdom that China is or has experienced moral decay, because there are signs that Chinese society is probably going through what I might call an incipient phase of moral rebirth. So so what evidence do I have to show that this might be the case? Because the essence of ethical choice is freedom, is choice of moral morality. Because so if you want to measure whether a society is doing the right thing, the first premise is whether the society has been given a choice to do the right thing. So when you look at how Chinese society responds to opportunities of choice, of course you can see negative manifestations of abnormal behavior or behavior we would not endorse. However, at the same time, you also see very impressive, welcome signs of ethical behavior. And let me just give you a few examples. One example I would cite is the rapid growth of religious groups, Christian groups in particular. And we see also now a connection between religious groups and lawyers who defend human rights, citizenship rights. I just had a meeting with a friend from China, and one of the things he told me is that all those lawyers, if you take bother to check their religious affiliations, are all Christians. And this is a very interesting phenomenon. And to me, it shows that individuals, once they have a choice, we should trust that they are going to make the right choice. And the growth of religious groups and emergence of rights defenders and their affiliation with those groups is one piece of evidence. And this piece of evidence is, as I would say, even more remarkable, because we have to consider the enormous repressive pressure these groups have to operate under in China. And the second piece of evidence is the growth of charitable donations and organizations in China. I looked at the number. I have not been able to verify this, but this is from Professor Yan Zhonghuang, a colleague, and I trust Dali's students, I trust that he must have checked out his numbers. And he said as of 2012, total amount of charitable donations in China exceeded $13 billion. That's a big number. I calculate by that year, probably it's about 0.2% of GDP. This came from nowhere. China used to have zero. So over that period of, the last 35 years since reform began, from zero to 0.2% of GDP is a huge progress. So if you believe that this number says something about social morality or social ethics, I would say we are doing pretty well. Or China is doing pretty well. Not as good as the U.S. The U.S. number is much, much bigger. The U.S. probably is between 1% and 2%. But the U.S. is always the leader on that front. And the third aspect, piece of evidence, is that the Internet in recent years has really become a very powerful tool for both rallying behavior that we would consider manifestations of social ethics. But also, the Internet has become a mechanism for enforcing ethical behavior. And I'll give you just a few examples here. I have a friend, very well known in China, called Yu Jianrong, most of us know. He founded a charity all through he has about 2 million followers on Weibo. He noticed that China has a lot of homeless people. In Beijing, beneath bridges, government would put nails to prevent them from sleeping on bridges. So he organized an effort to donate a heavy coat to these people, to homeless people. And every year he said he could collect 1 million. All through the internet, 1 million overcoats for homeless people in China. And there's another charity he talked to me about, which he was not part of, that organized free lunches for poor students in schools, because the government does not provide free lunches. And that charity has grown a great deal as well. And another example, again, associated with Yu Jianren, was a few years ago, he noticed a lot of children begging on streets. And he launched this citizen movement to ask people to take pictures of young kids begging on street corners and then send it to him, and he would distribute. And that alone saved about 3,000 young boys, mostly boys, who some of them were kidnapped, some of them were coerced into begging. So these are, I would say, these are the really uplifting examples of a society that probably is going through moral rebirths. And the last example, I would say that Chinese society has also shown an impressive ability to make its own choices on the issue of morality. And this, because in recent years, as Professor Hu said, the government has never tired of trying to manufacture morality or enforce, impose its own conception of morality. So, Ba Rong Ba Ci, this A Glories, A Shames, and 24 definitions or 24 elements of social morality. Most people cannot remember, right? But when you look at how Chinese society responds, they reject official imposition or official artificial manufactured morality, and they embrace their own. And I see this really as another sign that Chinese society has reached a level of maturity, moral maturity, that they can make their own choices. The second part of my talk is less optimistic, because I think that the biggest obstacle to moral rebirth in China is really the one-party system in China. Because the essence, as I said, of ethical behavior is choice, is freedom. You just cannot, it's impossible, I think historically, based on my very limited knowledge, you just cannot find ethical behavior thriving in a dictatorship or under tyranny. Just not. It does not simply, the two are incompatible. So the challenge for China is that how can genuine ethical moral standards or be improved, or ethical conduct be practiced in daily life in a system in which lies, distortion of facts are the rule. Just one thing, as Professor Xu said, when you have an official history, that if you bother to read it, probably 95% is lies. How can a society that seeks to achieve a higher level of moral standard really deal with this political structure? So I think as long as that system stays in place, it will be very, very hard. The last point I want to make is that I think that rebirth of moral social morality in China poses a real threat, political threat. One is that because in trying to really be truthful to yourself, you need truth, and the effort to see truth will undermine the party's, what I call the party's founding myths in China. The second one is that in order to practice social morality, you actually need civil society, as Professor He said. And organizing civil society is viewed as a political threat to the to the current political system in China. And that's why I think one of the saddest events that occurred in China in the last couple of years is the demolishing of crosses, churches in Zhejiang. At some point, I think the person who is responsible for this will have to be punished, either by God or by the anti-corruption authorities in China. Last one, I want to say that this is counterintuitive. I would say, even though the Communist Party has been decrying the moral collapse of China, I submit that the Communist Party would see a society with moral collapse as an asset. The party would welcome a society in which there are no morality, moral behavior, for the following reasons. Because in such a society, you're going to see it's going to be a chaotic society. It will be a society ruled, governed by the law of the jungles. And in that kind of society, there will be more justification for iron-fisted rule. The second reason for that statement is that in that society, material needs, not spiritual needs, not sense of justice would prevail. And that kind of society actually is easier to govern than a society that wants to have a clear answer on justice, on the issue of social justice and morality. And last point is that in this kind of society, any opposition can be bought, can be co-opted with material incentives. So this is a society, again, from a one-party perspective, probably is an asset. Moral collapse in that kind of society is an asset. So I leave you with a split picture. Is that on the one side, we are seeing signs of moral rebirth in a society that's becoming more independent, more mature, but at the same time, we have to be aware of the real political obstacles to a society in which moral rebirth actually is happening. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yunxiang, over
Thank
to you.
You. Well, we have a lot of political scientists here, so I don't need to worry about the political side. What I'm going to do is to introduce some of my observations from a more sociological, anthropological perspective. But I will be at my best if I can tell stories. And give me enough time, I'll tell you numerous stories. The stories themselves will demonstrate the points, but I cannot do that today. So what I'm going to do is to elaborate the following four points. One is that at the larger societal context, what we have witnessed in China in the past 30 plus years is a social transformation, which I called individualization of the Chinese society without individualism. Okay, which can be broken down into the following parts. One is at the subjective domain, you have seen the increasing rise of self-awareness, which include both individuals' desires and individual rights. This is in the subjective domain. In the objective domain, you have seen, on one hand, the government-sponsored institutional reforms that push more burdens on the shoulders of the individual, which is the essence of the China's success of market-oriented reforms. On the other hand, due to the subjective domain's change, there is increasing competition in the society, which fundamentally changed interpersonal relations in Chinese society. Third, there is also this continuing misunderstanding of what individualism is, which started from the turn of the 20th century. During that time, the Chinese elite thought individualism was the weapon to strengthen China because it promoted selfishness and antisocial behavior, independence, so on and so forth, which is only one side of individualism. The other side has never been properly introduced into China. Even up to the day, most Chinese understanding of individualism remains in the early the turn of the 20th century, that model. Lastly, along with this transformation of Chinese society at the level of social behavior, we see diversity. A constant increasing of diversity in both social behavior and other aspects of the society, which was also further driven by the increasing opportunities of mobility, both physical and social. That's the first point. The second point is, against this background of a social transformation, what we have witnessed in the last 3 decades is a moral and ethical transformation. Here, I made a distinction between moral and ethical because, at least in my discipline, morality mostly refers to behavior level things, what we do. But ethics is more like moral reasoning. It we think, we elaborate what we ought to do. First, there has been an ethical shift from a collective ethics, which emphasizing on obligations and self-sacrifice, and also oriented toward delayed gratification. For instance, we work very hard for the glory of ancestors. 2, a more individualistic ethics, which emphasizing on individuals' rights, desires, and self-development with the orientation toward instant gratification. We want the things we want here and now. Beneath this ethical shift are 2 more conditions. One is China's unfinished task of the politics of emancipation, which has a long way to go and more complicated things to elaborate. But to cut the long story short, although everybody knows it is important, it's desirable to have individual rights, but how to get there, especially how to get there at the same time to guarantee other people's equal rights, remains an unsolved issue. And another condition underneath this ethical shift is the rapid development of a consumerist ideology, which was in part encouraged by the Chinese government state ever since the late 1980s. So China has an unfinished task of emancipation politics and also a full-grown consumerist culture. So that's the second point. Third point, if we shift from ethics to morality, look at what happened in the past several decades. What I saw is a moral transformation instead of a moral decay, instead of moral rebirth. So I have to put myself somewhere different from both of the two people spoke before me. In this transformation, we can identify 3 domains of changes in moral behavior. One is what I called absolute immorality. Trust me, I did some empirical research. I published some things. One is about extortion of Good Samaritans, and another one is about food safety issues in China. The third one is a more general review of immorality in Chinese society, which is absolutely true, obvious, but mostly is eye-catching. That is also the base we call moral decay. The second one is new morality. New morality, my best friend Minxin just elaborated some, so I don't need to repeat. And also Professor He started actually with a new morality anecdote, that is how the young people in the public transportation system giving up their seats to the elderly, which is also true. But what I wanted to emphasize is one more point, that is both immorality and new morality occurred in the very new social domain, that is the domain where strangers encounter with strangers. You could do very bad things to strangers. You could do very good things to strangers. So this is absolutely new. How to deal with strangers, in my view, is remaining the biggest challenge of China's moral transformation. Because China used to be a society of acquaintances. The third domain is what I call the contested morality. contested moral behavior, which can be further break down into two parts. One is it is contested simply because the different perspectives across the lines of age, gender, class, economic status, or belief, like a religious perspective. Examples you can think of it. One very concrete example is a few years ago, there was this general call of a moral crisis in the Chinese countryside because so many Chinese women in the rural area divorced their husband. And they divorced their husband because they went to the city to work. They saw new horizons of life, and then they simply ran away. Is that a moral decay? If it is, from whose perspective? Do these women have the freedom to make their choice, to remake their own life? Okay, so another part of this contested morality has a lot to do with a temporal perspective. Life course changes. Here is the issue about post-18ers, post-19ers, the behavior. For instance, the post-18ers generation now, in the last 5 years, has picked up a lot of responsibilities, has changed their behavior, changed their views, so on and so forth. This is one thing. Another thing is that yesterday's immorality could be today's amoral, neutral behavior and could well possibly be tomorrow's moral behavior. One thing, one sharp example in this is homosexuality in China. The last point I want to make is, given what I have said, what you can see is that in the Chinese moral landscape, diversity is, I still have 5 minutes, I only need two. Diversity is the new thing, right? And that's why the contested morality sphere or domain is the most interesting part. However, in Chinese cultural system, has not been a ready available approach to embrace, not even to embrace, to deal with diversity. So far, nearly all the efforts of moral reforms stick with one wishful thinking. That is, we need to find the system that could create a new consensus, that could be our new moral authority. Everybody follow with that. Which I would argue, under the condition of modernity, probably will be very difficult, if it is possible at all. So by pushing for this new version of moral authority, virtually everyone wants to impose his or her view and using that perspective as the new consensus. And then you create a war, a cultural war, about what should be the moral ethical things. And so that I would say two issues facing China. One is how to deal with strangers at the behavioral level. Two is at the ethical level, how to deal with diversity remains to be a biggest challenge in China. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That was terrific. Dali, over to you.
It's really great to join this group, and thank you, Evan, and of course, thank you, Cheng, for organizing such a great event, and it's truly a lot of pleasure to engage with Professor He's works. He's published prolifically and also on very important matters. What I find especially instructive in many ways is the way that he engages both with what is in Chinese culture, in Chinese tradition, and also the way he reaches to the West in terms of both classical philosophies as well as modern philosophies. So it's in this process that he's seeking not only a critique of what is happening in contemporary China, and of course in reflection with China's traditions and histories, but also how he's proposing his trying to find a way for China to get out of its moral predicament, but at the same time with a system that actually transcends Chinese tradition, Chinese history, and also connects China with the modern world. And I think it's a remarkable undertaking. His book in particular, and of course many of you have his English book in terms of the new ethics, but in fact he has especially a book entitled Xingangchang in Chinese, which is very wide-ranging, but also is very, it's truly remarkable in its almost like actually in a classical sense of more modern Western political theories as well. And I think actually this is a very unique opportunity in terms of his thinking, in thinking about the reconstruction of the Chinese moral order. But in many ways, it's not simply moral. It's also about the political and the social and so on. And in this case, I think actually what's interesting, for example, is how he rephrases traditional Chinese ethical order in terms of, for example, he emphasizes the Xin Zheng Min in talking about Guan Guan Min Min, Ren Ren Wu Wu, in thinking about how you can sort of think and reorder the moral and political universe in China in ways. And I found it a remarkable read in this case. And when towards the end of that book, it goes back to the issue, what can we do? Of course, Ambassador Roy asked him, for example, how do you limit power? The ethicist in this case is not obligated to provide all the tools, Yan Wei, in making the transition. Although he is also very modest in thinking, well, what I'm offering is a more the minimal standards. What are the minimal standards? Of course, in the conversation earlier, he was actually being prompted by the questions to speak about the differences, that in fact you may have a Chinese or American stomach, although the Chinese stomach is part of the American stomach too, I think actually, in a way. But what is interesting is how he goes back to some basics in terms of the protection of life and property. And of course there, I find that what he's speaking about is actually not just connecting with Chinese traditions, but also connecting with what he was referring to, what the American presidents used to read. But of course, today we do actually have a constitutional scholar in the White House who happens to be also from the University of Chicago. So I think we are elevated quite well. But in fact, we can also afford to have presidents not to read and recite from Locke anymore, because our predecessors did read Locke and incorporate Locke into our constitution and so on. And what I think actually Professor He is trying to do is also to do the same for the new Chinese moral, social, and political order in a way that, in fact, also my colleagues here have referred to. And here I think I also hear a passionate plea. In the book, later on, he emphasizes the urgency. What do you need to do? And here, actually, I think Professor He was very modest this morning in not trying to get to that in a way. But what I... when I read, I really saw his frustration with how there are a lot of falsehoods being told. When Professor Pei also mentions how you cannot trust the official histories, that a lot of the moral predicament in China today, the problems are not caused by society. As I here, I fully agree with Professor Pei, in fact. In fact, it's the politics that drives a lot of the problems in China today. And in this context, I want to speak to especially the issue of trust, because I happen to have done some empirical research on this matter, in fact. And we do know that social capital is extremely important for economic development, for really building our order. In fact, it's remarkable also we actually try to engage to find out about Chinese social trust in this, because very often you read about results from social and political surveys. Chinese trust in political institutions are extraordinarily high. But immediately people ask, can you trust the trust numbers? Especially when you ask people, do you trust the central leaders, the central institutions? More than 90% of the Chinese say yes. And then immediately people say, can I really trust you to say that you trust the central right? Because people are asking and answering the questions in a more truncated, in a system whereby maybe people, the respondents, are not at will in answering those kind of questions. So then we try to figure out how to deal with this issue, because we can ask people to answer questions about not only trust about the central institutions, where they say 90% of them say they trust. We also ask them to answer questions about trust in local authorities. Here the numbers immediately come down, in fact, to around 60%. 60%, but also with significant variations, in fact. Then suddenly it becomes much more interesting. And also, you find that, in fact, there are significant variations across the country. For example, we find that a lot of the issues today related to political trust is related to issues of land takings, food safety, for example. We find, for example, in all those matters, if people had experienced adverse actions by the authorities in particular, they are likely to be less trusting of the local authorities. If they had had their land taken by the authorities, and of course usually they are on the end, they are the victims of efforts by the authorities to pay them less, then their land is worse in the market, therefore they are likely to be less trusting of the local authorities and so on. And then we try to figure out, social scientists have a way, there's a massive industry studying the issue of social trust. But we also have a lot of questions about trust. It is a puzzle. And also, what is the relationship between social and political trust? High social trust helps with political trust, and perhaps vice versa. But what is the direction? How do you truly find out? In fact, my co-authors and I have tried to deal with this issue in the Chinese context. But here is really interesting, because here again also Professor Yan was emphasizing how a lot of the trust in the Chinese system is based on intra-group trust. This morning I read a little piece from a professor at Beijing University, in fact, who emphasizes all trust in China is about family lineage. In fact, Professor He himself goes in, to some extent in that direction in thinking about this. But there is a standard question derived from the General Social Survey, which continues to be conducted by the University of Chicago affiliated group, essentially ask you about the trust of strangers. Do you think that people can generally be trusted? Or do you think that you should be careful with most of the times? And this is the question that asked around the world, including in China. And in the survey that we analyzed, we also asked the same question. And then there is the question people think, can we truly trust that the Chinese answer the same question as well, right? So then the social scientists in recent years have started to introduce this concept called the radius of trust. Do you think you are really trusting your fellow friends, or instead you are trusting more generally? I think actually, just based on common sense, I think people trust quite a bit. This is again where I agree with Professor Pei. How else can people buy all the fake foods and fake goods and all that if they don't trust, actually? So sort of you think about it. It's, on the one hand, it's a bad sign that there are a lot of things, bad things happen. But it's also the fact that many Chinese invest massive amounts of money in all sorts of schemes because they trust. Isn't that right? So when we actually make the adjustments and all that, we control for all the variables, we actually find that the Chinese are very high on social trust. Which is, again, why people in China can develop so rapidly, because people are willing to make the investments, in fact. So even after making all the adjustments, we find that today, actually, China compares well with France, Spain, South Korea, so both developed European countries, and, of course, Confucian, a country with very strong Confucian tradition. China ranks among those countries. So China doesn't do very badly at all in that case in terms of social trust. We also do find, and we have a way which in statistical terms is called instrumental variables. We try to test how can you the linkage between political and social trust. We do find also political trust in China significantly affects social trust. In other words, if China wants to rebuild, to sustain the level of high social trust, it really needs to build its politics. Here, in fact, remarkably, I find that I'm fully in agreement with Professor He in terms of his new ethics for China, in thinking about a lot of the challenges facing China would be the reconstruction of politics. If you can reorder the politics, in fact, that the system has to tell more truth to allow people to be more authentic, then, in fact, China already has very strong social conditions in that case. And here, I think I'm a little less, I would be in disagreement with Professor Pei. He's a master in arguments. I think he may have deliberately set this out for me in some way, in the sense that he thinks that the CCP would probably even welcome moral decay. I think actually, I do think the CCP has a sense that it wants to have a stronger society in terms of trust and so on, as long as they trust the CCP. But in order to do so, the CCP had to make the people trust it, right? So in that sense, actually, what Professor He has done is a remarkable effort to help think through those issues, but also build it on universal foundations. And let me end in this case on his, what he's building actually is on this phrase called common humanity. And I think, again, this is a remarkable effort by him to transcend Chinese and Western in a way in thinking that in rebuilding ethics and politics in China, you have to build on this common humanity. For the very simple reason, used to be China can do it all by itself because it's in its own universe. It couldn't learn from the West. But now that we have all this knowledge, we have all the experiences, we have all those interactions. For example, 275,000 Chinese students are studying in the U.S. alone. Then what's the justification for not borrowing? Of course, the CCP itself borrowed, took Marxism. But today, we can't just do that anymore. We have to do more. And that foundation has to rest on the common humanity. So let me end there. Thank you.
That was terrific. Well, thank you all to the three of you. I hear, and also, of course, in Professor He's comments, there is the one point of consensus is that this is a moment of moral turbulence, whether or not we are on the process of rebuilding or still in the process of decay or whether these go on at the same time. One thing that I think is interesting hearing all of your comments today is that there are the factors that you identify as both contributing and demonstrating this phenomenon are different. So, for instance, in Min Xin's case, you draw out the technological element, which is Yu Jianrong can go on the internet and can forge, in a sense, a moral conversation with people he doesn't meet face to face, with a couple of million of his followers, and he can, in a sense, recruit them or coordinate with them to participate in moral activity. I thought it was also interesting that Yunxiang, you identified the sort of logistical, geographical fact of modern life, which is that you encounter people outside of your immediate kinship and family circles, and this interaction with strangers forces people into a new moral moment as they go into the city and they encounter people that they haven't met before. And then, of course, in Dali's case, I thought you identified the point that I want to now develop further, which is the role of institutions. And principally, of course, that would be the role of the government. In many ways, we've circled around this subject of what is the potential role for the government in the moral life of China today and tomorrow. And if I could ask you, Dali, to just talk for a moment about whether you think fundamentally is the party today, the party state, let's say, in the position to be an impediment to a moral life in China, or is it in fact capable of being a catalyst for a more moral life?
Well, that's a very broad question in many ways. I think it's an important question, although in this case, when you talk about institutions, we are not just talking about government institutions in many ways. Of course, this morning earlier, we were talking about the shared observation that, for example, the government is beginning to be engaged in developing a social credit rating system. I want actually to begin with my observation about Chinese restaurants, because a lot of the issues we face and a lot of things that people worry about is food safety. Yeah, Yun Xiang has written on this. I personally have also written it. And Cheng had spoken specifically on this issue. But you go to China today, increasingly, one of the reasons many Chinese likes to visit McDonald's and KFC in the past is they go for the experience in many ways because that's a sure way to find a clean restaurant in the past. But of course, after the last couple of years, they also realize even those restaurants can be subject to problems and so on. But what's remarkable in recent years is the development increasingly of restaurant chains. For example, there is a chain called Xibei Youmian, and so on. It's the experience is remarkable. You have the server come to you practically swearing that they guarantee the quality of the food and so on. And that, in fact, they have also accused the kosher foods, the emergence of chains like that. So social institutions have a certain way to gradually develop. And of course, we go back and remember President Reagan used to say on nuclear inspections is trust but verify. What's interesting is online institutions, as they have developed increasingly, there are also some ways through public comments and other things. Social individuals are being harnessed to provide opinions on restaurants, on those kind of including goods and so on. So I think actually it's not simply a government aspect. It's actually social institutions. Let me end by also mentioning a phenomenon we have at the University of Chicago Center is in the University District in Beijing, right outside of Renmin University, in fact, where usually there are a lot of people peddling to sell you fake university certificates or graduate diplomas. Let me assure you, a diploma from Peking University is worth much less on the black market than one from an obscure college. Why is it so? Because over time, the Chinese government has developed online databases that you can search and verify the degree certificates. So if you come from a major university, easily that can be searched and verified, and therefore the value of a diploma or ID from Beijing University is not worth much anymore. Instead, it has to be an obscure institution that you can't search for it anymore practically. And this is happening in many areas, and this goes back to what Minxin has done. And I think you can talk about a lot of those other things. Environmental institutions, again, they are verifiable. So increasingly, there are local authorities that are suspected of manipulating data. But then increasingly the environmental data are released in real time so that you can't really manipulate it anymore. A lot of those things are beginning to happen, and therefore I think actually in the process is actually making the Chinese are heavily engaged socially and politically in rebuilding those kind of institutions.
In a few minutes we're going to turn to your questions, but before we do, Yunxiang, I wondered if you would help us think a little bit about an element in your work, which is the rural experience and also the urban experience, because sometimes it's easy for us to say we can write off phenomena in China by saying, well, this may be going on in the city, but it's not going on in the countryside, or vice versa. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on these days? Are we seeing a merger of these two moral experiences, or do they remain, for practical and deeper reasons, do you have a separate experience if you're living in a county town versus if you're living in a big city?
Well, if you are alluded to the general assumption that moral landscape in the countryside should be better, Now my answer is a direct, straightforward no. Mm-hmm. It could be worse. It actually being worse in many places. If you think of food safety issues, who were the vendors and the producers of those fake, faulty, poisoned food? Most of them are from the countryside, right? But they didn't do this in their own hometown. They didn't sell those to the people they knew. So it's not a matter of urban-rural divide. It's rather the divide between acquaintances with acquaintances or strangers to strangers.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think that's the critical part of China's contested morality and moral transformation.
Minxin, you know, your book that's coming out on the subject of crony capitalism, you know, Xi Jinping in some ways has done advanced publicity for you with his anti-corruption campaign by drawing attention to this.
I quote him at the beginning of every chapter.
Well, maybe you'll get a blurb from him on the back of the book. I want, if I can, I'll co-opt Ambassador Roy's question for a moment and ask what your research led you to at the end. Did you arrive at the conclusion that the system today is able to do the sort of self-corrective mechanisms that have been both so elusive in Chinese history and also would appear to be at the moment so difficult for the party to accept? Or is, in fact, the process that we're seeing now capable? Is it up to the task of putting China back onto a more stable moral and political footing?
Well, the short answer is no, because the current campaign is a campaign from within the system. And over the last 35 years, the party has launched, I stopped counting, I don't know how many, but many, many campaigns. And these campaigns work for a brief period of time. But if you do not go after the underlying causes, decay, political decay or institutional decay comes back, multiplied, actually. So the real reason, because this is something I've been working on for 3 years, I looked at 260 cases involving multiple officials. We're talking about crony capitalism in the sense of corruption networks, not just individual conduct. And the conclusion I draw from this study is that when you have a group of political elites in control of enormous economic wealth, crony capitalism is the inevitable outcome if political power is not placed under institutional constraints.
I want to stay with you for 1 second. Before we turn to the question, I just can't resist. I'm curious, you know, the context for our conversation today is in some ways self-contained. Yeah. We're talking about China's internal dynamics. But I think it's worth asking the question about why those of us here abroad should actually care about China's internal moral conversation. And I say that I'll be provocative for a moment to say we look around the world and we see barbarism and tyranny and collapse in so many parts of the world. And in China, there is stability of a certain kind. Certainly there is sustenance, there are the basic conditions of human life. Is this a conversation that in the end doesn't lead us to a relevant conclusion, or should we care about what's going on?
I think we all care about China because we want China to do better, because China is important to us, to our lives, to the world. When you read yesterday's New York Times that China is burning 70% more coal, I think we all have to worry about the future of the planet. That's frankly, we cannot compare China with Syria, with Iraq. I think people in China will be extremely offended because they see themselves as future Americans. Mm. What they are doing is not what they're doing is much, much better than what they did on the Mao. But we worry that it's not enough.
And we are connected. Their moral decisions affect us over here and vice versa. Let's open this up to questions. I would encourage you, please, to remember to ask a question, not make a statement, and to try to confine it to one question so that we get as many people in as possible. And we'll start right here with Mike in the fourth row.
Mike Macedic, PBS Online NewsHour. There seems to be a contradiction to come out of both panels, or they're contradictory campaigns. One is the anti-corruption campaign, although you have to determine is that against corruption or just to get rid of inconvenient people. And secondly, the campaign going on against NGOs. Can those two campaigns go on in tandem, or is one or the other going to just collapse?
Anybody want to take that, Minxin?
Yeah. Well, I think this illustrates, your question really illustrates the point most of us were trying to make. That is, one of the causes of what we consider the moral challenges China faces is really government decision, the use of power. How can a government, decrying moral decline at 1 minute, and then the next minute going after the sources of moral renewal in China?
Well, I would not to say that in China there is a campaign against NGOs. You look at the universe of NGOs in China, for example, there are a lot of NGOs that the Chinese government is encouraging and working with, for example, in the area of environmental protection. But at the same time, there are certain NGOs that the government is heavily wary of and has cracked down. So in that sense, and also for the same reason, in a way, I think in the case of corruption, however, it's gone further than simply tackling one's political opponents. There is an institutional sort of drive towards it as well. Overall, I would put all of this under the term regulation. But regulated, however, within a one-party system, and with the fundamental interests of the one-party system in mind, and therefore, what we see is in certain aspects of this effort, we like. In certain aspects of the effort, we also see things that we really don't like.
Yeah, back there, there's a question.
Thank you very much for coming and speaking with us. This is very important, and thanks, Brookings. My name is Andy Steele. I work at Rain, a corporate risk company. And my question is, when you're talking about social trust, Dr. Chung Li offered earlier the quotation translated of the economic policy has forced China to lose some of its morality. And I'm wondering about economics affecting social trust. And I can think of coastal regions being richer than inland. China has the second most number of billionaires after the U.S. Even the hukou system, citizens in their own city might feel like they're disincentivized from using social programs like hospitals and schooling. So what aspects of economic policy do you think should be most quickly addressed to encourage social trust? Thank you.
Well, let me speak to this issue since it's especially relates to the article that I had co-authored. Let me actually begin by saying, however, that it's not necessarily true that the higher trust, the better. You don't want blind trust also. So one of the reasons developed societies do not have extraordinarily high trust is we also tend to have critical citizens who are skeptical, who are wary, and who really don't want, for example, strong power in the federal government and so on. And that actually is healthy as well. So you want a mixture of trust, but also a certain degree of skepticism and distrust as well in any society. So in that sense, therefore, the question is, what are the patterns in China? What we find is, in fact, in coastal regions, in fact, in China, trust tend to be a little lower. So you do find that in the less developed areas, trust is higher. So in that sense, actually, in certain cases, you want, on average, a decent level of trust. But you also don't want to have extraordinarily low levels of trust. We actually also find a very strange, interesting phenomenon. Communist Party members tend to have lower trust.
So it's not strange at all.
That's right. So I'm still trying to figure out what does it really mean. But overall, though, actually, it's a sort of certainly you want to develop institutions. Used to be in the West, for example, one of the issues I have studied is blood safety. Mm-hmm. We used to emphasize how we want to encourage simply blood donations. In fact, the UK emphasized you should be simply blood donations is better than blood actually sort of offers with remuneration. But in the end, actually the systems converged because you can't fully trust anybody anymore. Right? So in that sense, actually you have to develop institutions, and I think modern societies today have to rely on regulation in many ways. But at the same time, you want people to have the sense of generosity and trust. And it's that healthy combination that matters.
I'd like to follow your comments on this issue as well. That is, in addition to trust, that there's civility. So in a modern society, you need probably the appropriate level of trust, not too much, not too strong, not too weak, but also need civility to support it. Civility could be further break down into mutual respect, consideration, and tolerance. So in But that three factors, you can see actually in the more developed coastal areas, there's a higher degree of civility. And the reverse is also true if you think about the inland. For instance, Shanghai, you have probably the highest civility, comparatively speaking, in Chinese cities. And then you have probably a higher degree of distrust, which could work toward a positive end as well.
I think, yeah, there's a question right here on the third row. Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Hannah Hindle. I'm at CSIS in the China Power Project. And one question that I've been thinking about throughout the talks today has been the government's appeal to young people in particular, a sort of top-down expectation of an ability to either influence or, I guess, impose a certain type of morality. Since 1963, we see campaigns every single year. March 5th comes around, and we see Xiang Liefeng Xue Xi, like we see the model emulation campaigns, right? He's dead, but he's not. And so what I would be interested to hear what the panel thinks of kind of what the success potential there is in part for the government to actually have a real influence on the morality and the value systems of young people. And is there an ulterior motive there? And if so, what is it?
The repeated use of Lei Feng really shows how unimaginative the propaganda department has become. Young people, if you deal with them, you know, they actually are very independent thinking. The last thing you want to do to a group of young people in China today is to tell them what to do. they would precisely do the opposite. That's why one of the points I make is that whenever you give Chinese society an opportunity to make the choice, they make the right choice, but you do not impose a set of choices. That's why the Chinese Communist Party has been very frustrated in its inability to foster or build new role models for the young generation. The only area that the party has been successful is not to build new models, but to fan nationalism. But that's a very entirely, that's a very different issue. Yeah.
If you look at the young people's behavior, you can see actually in public domain, when dealing with strangers, younger generations tend to show a higher level of number one, civility, number two, mutual understanding of the other party. But if you look at the older generation, they tend to do better toward the people they know in their own circles. So it's just dealing with two different populations. But even within the young Chinese people, you have the further difference between the post-18ers and the post-19ers. Because the post-19ers really was born into affluent society, increasingly so. They have different concerns, and so there's a further difference. But if lumping them all together, this is what I early on alluded that it is almost like a dead end. If you deal with the increasingly diversified moral landscape from a unified version or perspective, and mostly I refer to this government-sponsored top-down moral reform efforts. In that sense, I think what Professor He suggested is could be a very healthy and functional approach.
Well, I think it's interesting when Professor Yan mentions how young people may behave today. Of course, this is a generation that have no brothers or sisters in the urban areas, so they have to reach out in some ways because they cannot go to their brothers and sisters anymore. They have already, I see the phenomenon of families broadening. You reach out to cousins and so on, much more. And then by extension, younger people tend to be more, in essence, more outgoing. I think actually you raise one of the most profound questions facing Chinese education today, because this is where you want to go online. And what you find is there are a lot of comments that are very challenging. Just this morning I received actually someone sent me a picture of the rules governing for pupils in China. And they are all critical of this, basically saying the Chinese ones tend to have things that are very abstract and lofty. For example, the first line, let me read it out. Love the motherland. Love the people. Love the Communist Party of China. And then all those circulated posts online then begin to say, what do you What are the Americans and others tell their kids to do, right? And there are a lot of comments about what happens to in American schools. I have kids who have gone through schools here, so sort of, and all that. And we know how they have to do their independent projects. They learn about the American Revolution. We are a revolutionary. We studied the revolution and all that. But they learn it from the bottom of their heart in many ways. They go through this process. In China, everyone, the young pupils basically are told, you have to recite those correct results in order to pass the exams. And that's actually a significant difference. And one of the reasons many people send their kids abroad is because they are unhappy with the Chinese system in such a way. They want to send, to have their kids, their only children, in many ways, to have an authentic educational experience. So therefore, I think actually this is where I'm much more hopeful as well, because we do have a new generation of people in China today who have access to information, who can think for themselves. And for the first time also, most of them are going, at least have a high school education and more. In fact, 7.5 million people graduate from colleges each year today, more than 2 times as many as in the United States. So we have a remarkable generation of younger people who are going to be thinking differently, who have the information, and who can act differently as well in the future. And however frustrated we may be, as Professor He is, in fact, with some of the political developments, what's remarkable is time is remarkable in that they always usher in new generation, this new generation in China, are young, but they also have all the information, and they are going to be more critical citizens.
I think we have time just for one or two more questions in the way in the back there. I think we've got a question.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Barbara from Fletcher School for Law Diplomacy, and my question is, how do scientists and social scientists and political scientists evaluate the increasing decade of moral standard in China and an increasing the lack of social trust in China can be correlated to the increasing China's activity to or tendency to challenge the current global order, and increasingly China's tendency to use a militarized measure to solve the either dispute in land and sea, and an increase in China's tendency to set up the order to centering around themselves, and the domestic phenomenon of stranger meeting stranger can be adopted to evaluate the international scenario phenomena that the China actually is increasingly active in the global stage, whilst lacking of a trust on the current global.
And we've got the microphone back there. We'll add this question right to your right there, and then we'll answer them both together.
Yes, 21st Century Business Herald. Two leaders from mainland and Taiwan will meet tomorrow for a historical meeting. So I wanted to, professors can share with us about the
moral
the similarity and differences across the strait in terms of political morality and political trust. Thanks.
I thought I'm done with my previous life as a talking head. And I guess it's not.
Do you see? Actually, I am curious too about the question of whether you see any difference in the moral experience right now in China and on the mainland and in Taiwan. Whether this bears into this.
I think if I have to make a very simple statement, Taiwan clearly is a society in which we would not use moral decay to characterize. Taiwan actually is a very well functioning society. So, whether that's going to be reflected in tomorrow's meeting, nobody knows.
And does anybody want to address this question? Whether there's an analogy?
At least I think what Taiwan is not launching an anti-corruption campaign. Yeah.
Do you see
Taiwan has an election campaign going on, but not an anti-corruption campaign? Yeah.
And on the first question, do you see any analogy between what's going
really
on in China's
hard.
Moral?
I think that's your the connection between internal morality and external. Militaristic behavior would have you. I think that's a PhD thesis.
But we, all right, we have the makings of another session someday on China's external moral behavior around the world. But before everybody leaves, please join me in thanking our panelists for a really stimulating.